to begin where people are, with the things that they think and care about, and the isolation of what are the gods in their lives. The explanation of the first commandment in the Large Catechism says, a man's God is that to which he looks from which to receive good. And to identify then what is the God or the gods in some, perhaps even make them more in his life than he's so far thought of them, pushing it all the way to as far as those gods can possibly carry him, help him, bring things to realization. And then it is when you have taken his gods for their full stretch, you come to the point where those gods can't reach any further. And then their inadequacy, the things that those gods are unable to deal with or to face, become apparent. And there is that whole range of living, of thinking, that his gods can't handle. The explanation to the first commandment in the Large Catechism says that, which is a very drastic thing, what's wrong isn't that people have false gods, but that they don't really believe them. The basic fault is not in the falseness of the God, but in their falseness of faith. They don't really believe their gods. And so you have to push people's belief in their gods to the full stretch of their God. And it is only when the God is really believed in, only when people put the whole weight of their lives upon their God and really believe in their God, that then their God will be seen as being able to bear that strain or crumble under that strain. There is only one who can stand the strain of being treated as God. And there is the recognition of this in the way people relate to their idols. They don't really believe their idols. They don't put the whole weight of their lives upon their idol. Being uncertain of an idol, of their idol, they usually have a number of idols. Being uncertain of any particular one, they will hedge their bets by having a number of them, so that if one failed, there'll be another. We are helpful to people not as coming in and knocking all their idols over, but in helping them see what is the full stretch, strength, potential of their idol or their whole range of idols, and so bringing them to the point where they can really, that their idol will be more than they supposed it was, but also helping them to come to the point where their idols give out and can't carry them through ranges of living and reality that their idols cannot face. An idol always has to be protected from some range of reality in order to survive. And we are able to do this because an idol, an idolatrous relationship destroys an idolatrous relationship is not only a restrictive one, it has to be held within a limited range of the data in order to survive, but an idolatrous relationship is also inherently destructive. These we had illustrated in this chapter with Mrs. Fidget and her relationship to her children and to her whole family. The mother who says that she lives for her children, and this may be literally the case, is loving them in a destructive way. I don't suppose that needs illustration. And it is mutually destructive, such an idolatrous relationship. For it is not only possessively smothering of the child, but it is also destructive of the mother. For the mother is asking her child to fulfill her life, give it meaning, hold it all together. She is making idol of her child. She is putting weight and expectations upon her child which her child cannot sustain, and that her child will be crushed and damaged by having imposed upon it. And inevitably those maternal expectations are disappointed. No child can fulfill that role for the mother. The mother will see her child fail her in that way, or most dramatically, if the child, well, dies, is harder to bear, I suppose, than that the child repudiates all of that and rebels from out of that suffocation. And then the woman falls apart. What's held her life together is gone, and she goes to pieces. Or there was the baker in the church that I served in London. When his bake shop burnt down, he went out of his mind. He couldn't face life anymore, because what held him together, what gave meaning to his life, was his bakery. When that was gone, he disintegrated, and there was the retreat then from that reality he couldn't face into insanity. I wanted to point up the insight that there is in the explanation to the first commandment in the Large Catechism, and some of the and a similarity of approach and technique in this chapter of affection. And at the end of each chapter through the book, Lewis comes to the point of saying, "It's affection is all this wondrous thing, this great magnitude, more than we'd imagine that it could be in our lives." Then he looks to the disease of affection, its inflation or hypertrophy, its putting on airs, its becoming pretentious, larger than itself, its going to an idolatrous dimension, and then at the end of the chapter, what keeps affection held for its full magnitude and running happily in our lives is when it is held within something larger, when it is carried along as a part of a wholeness. And the full stream of that wholeness, the underlying flow and current of a life in which affection has its full place and unhealthy place, is a life in which the basic flow is the love of God. that kind of love. But that kind of love not seen as alternative or threat to any of the loves in our lives, but that the loves in our lives can only be full size when they are nourished, informed, flowed along with the love of God. And so we, last time we ended up with the observation that we love strawberries best when we love God most. You see, that keeps us from idolatrous relationship with strawberries. The moment we develop an idolatrous relationship with strawberries, we destroy strawberries, just as the possessive mother destroys her child with her kind of love. And the joy of the relationship between me and strawberry and mother and child is inhibited and destroyed when that goes idolatrous. We can't love a strawberry when we love it too much, when we would inflate it beyond what it is as a strawberry. But when that strawberry is received as gift within our Father God's generosity and bountiful provision in our lives, and knowing that He is for us and that He is happy with us when we are happy in enjoyment of His gifts. Melanchthon defined worship as receiving God's gifts. God is most pleased with us when we are receivers and happy users of His gifts. And when they come to us that way, then they are not in danger of being more than Him, of displacing Him, or and so of inflation to idolatry, which is then also destructive. Idolatrous love looks like really loving something completely. It is loving excessively, idolatrously, destructively. In the, if one carries it through from the first commandment, it is as things are related to God that we know them for the full size that they are, and that can then be the happiness and the healthy sort of vital things in our lives. Anything that comes detached and would go it alone and do the God job is the thing then that can work this idolatrous destruction. One of the Caroline poets is quoted, I think, in Lewis also, where a man says to the woman he loves, when he is bidding her farewell to go and do what it is his task to do, he says to her, "I could not love you, dear, so much. I could not love thee, dear, so much, loved I not honor more." If she insisted that she should mean more for him than honor, she would be insisting on his loving her less. That would be an insistence upon a kind of love that would destroy them both. But when she knows that he is one who has what comes into that term honor there, he because of that, loves her in a more true, healthy, sort of living kind of love. Well, I just meant that to be something that I was saying until everybody got here. But the way in that I think when you read a chapter in this book, if you get sort of the strategy, the plot of it, and see what he's doing, then it helps you get the hang of it, and it also alerts you to the way he's getting at things, so that you know that he's up to, you know what he's up to, and then are also in a better position for reading it critically. You are then not so likely to be led down the garden path by anything that he says. Spot a man's technique and you are defensed against being led around by the nose. We'll be doing more of that next week when we look at the battle for the mind and the way in which we are nowadays so manipulable. We need to recognize the techniques of manipulation that are brought to bear upon us in order that we may be defensed against them. Similarly, when one reads a book like Lewis, one needs to be defensed against it. You never swallow anything that anybody says, but take it all critically and don't let yourself just be carried along or persuaded. We are so much at the receiving end of the manipulative persuasions operative in our society that unless we are keenly and critically aware of what's being done at us, we'll be played for suckers, or we will just be consumer items that one can statistically calculate and, with the techniques at our disposal, produced and manipulated. However, a warm affection C.S. Lewis may engender in us for himself, we may not allow that to blur a critical awareness of how he is getting at us and of our never evading the question, is it really so? Well, enough for introductory remarks. Any comment? Or anything that you found in this chapter that made you sort of stop and say, well, how can he say a thing like that? That's a bit far-fetched, or how does that tie in with the other thing? Yes, the Battle for the Mind by William Sargent, which will go into the bookstore tomorrow, so that people who are leaving today can't buy it and take it away with them. And so there'll be enough books to go around next week. It's called A Physiology of Conversion and Brainwashing. It's a frightening book, but that's next week's business. What of affection? You want to go on to friendship? Wonderful. Yeah, I think that's a marvelous chapter, the friendship one. because it's a whole dimension. Yes, I'm looking forward to friendship. But what about affection? Have we done the full appropriation assessment of affection?
Well, I never really considered parental love as being affection. It always seemed something that was supposed to be greater, you know? When you say, like, I have an affection for my parents, it just doesn't seem like that there's enough there, really, to cover what you're supposed to. But people tell you, or people expect you're supposed to feel for your parents. So I couldn't really see why I put it in that chapter. But yet, I looked at the other chapters and there's nowhere else you could put it. Except for if there's another kind of love, which there are supposed to be.
Yeah. Yeah, lots and lots and lots and lots more.
The word affection, I've always thought of affection as something that you do. Like, you hear the expression, well, they're not a very affectionate family. Or, I think affection with animals is cat. Something that you do rather than that you do. I say you can't show love, you can show love. But I would say that affection is something that you know you can see, see a family and say, well, they're not very affectionate. I think affection is pretty much just me.
I think it's a lot safer to say you have an affection for someone than that you love someone, you know? Like, a lot of times when I'm writing letters and I don't know what to finish off with, I just write affectionately, because that it's right in the middle and you're safe there. You know, no one misinterprets what you're trying to say.
Good. Good.
But I always feel a little guilty about it, too, because it's like a last resort. I have nothing else to say, so...
Now, Lewis would cure you of that, that you wouldn't feel sort of inadequate just because it was affection that was back and forth between you and somebody else. And it is, you open the door to disease if you say, well, that's not good enough. It ought to be more. Why isn't it more? And then you either crank it up or push it beyond what's the fact of the matter. And then you come into the realm of the phony, which is always diseased and destructive of any kind of thing going back and forth between people. And Lewis would say, affection, what a lot that is. And that it isn't under the pressure of having to prove itself by demonstration. I only kissed my wife twice yesterday, and if I really cared, it ought to at least be 100 times in a day. There was one on page, well, I don't know whether your page is the same. He speaks of affection as there is indeed a peculiar charm both in friendship and in eros about those moments when appreciative love lies, as it were, curled up asleep, and the mere ease and ordinariness of the relationship, free as solitude, no pressure being felt from the other person that you've got to be responding in order to keep a relationship going. You know that that's there because it's been going on a long time, and you don't have to be busy proving it. Free as solitude, yet neither is alone. Wraps us round. No need to talk, no need to make love, no needs at all, except perhaps to stir the fire. There is a kind of ease and being and taking somebody for granted. He uses that term, and which is usually a negative term. You're not supposed to take anybody for granted. But there is a confidence in a relationship that you're there, and I know you're there, and we don't have to make any fuss about it. And if I'm sort of weary and a bit grumpy, well, that's how he gets sometimes, but there he is. And that's not something that you have to sort of work on or get frantic about. That deep kind of confidence that grows with a... He spoke about the way in which the word old comes into this. And this, the failure to let that be so good in our lives and so large a part in our lives, the failure to let that be that and say, well, we ought to be more, is destructive or damaging of that whole range of things that are so good in our lives. I think this is a danger to which Christians are particularly prone. We're supposed to love everybody, and we ought to have a relationship with everybody, and so we work at getting relationships going with everybody. We need here also to recognize everybody's uniqueness. That is one of the sort of essentials of loving somebody. And our uniquenesses come under the heading of the first article of creation. And we run against that fact or rebel against that fact when we operate under the pressure to have a full relationship with everybody that we have contact with, that we should share the whole of ourselves with one another. The whole heart to heart and gut to gut flow back and forth with nothing impeding it. We're not made that way. I bump into this a great deal where people are having trouble with their roommate in the dormitory at the university. A Christian is wanting to share with the roommate and wanting to that they might come to pray together is a thing that is worked toward. I'm not knocking that, but that impulse to share Christ gets shifted over into an imposed demand to share everything and not being willing to accept the other person's anotherness. We are to share to the extent that we're able to, but let it be the extent that we're able to, and not destroy that by continually donging on for it to be more. Not everybody thinks the jokes are funny that I think are funny. Not everybody thinks the jokes are funny that I think are funny. And if I have a roommate who is such a clod as not to see how funny my jokes really are, it doesn't help one bit to go on telling him the sort of jokes that I think are most supremely funny. He just hasn't got that in his equipment. There will doubtless be things that make him feel similarly about me. Or one has great joy in a particular song or kind of music, and you grab your roommate and say, "Hey, I got this record, you must hear it." And then your roommate sits there, you know. You should make the attempt. If your roommate then comes to share that music and have joy of it, great. I mean, then you've had another advance. You're still pushing further the amount of things that you can share. But, and you sort of might try again, but you're not going to sort of feel that you've failed as a Christian if he makes rather derogatory remarks about the sort of music that you like. And you find this too in courting. They will each try and share the other's interests as much as possible. And she will go along to the baseball game and be utterly bored. Be much rather doing something else. But he loves to go, and she wants to show that she's a good sport, and she'll pretend that going to the baseball game is an invitation that she gladly accepts. And then when they've been married a few years, she says to him, "You know, I think baseball's a frightful bore. You go to your baseball game, and I'll go and see Susan this afternoon, who needs some help with getting the dinner ready for her guests tonight. And they can both go and do something that they really enjoy." The husband that would insist that their marriage was encountering some sort of blockage by her inability to rejoice in baseball with him, you see, is failing to acknowledge that is under the first article of the creed. We are created such as either having a capacity to love baseball or a capacity not to love baseball, and we aren't to be going donging on about that. So to let each relationship be as much as it can of sharing, but to acknowledge the limitations of that. There are people with whom we can share very little. There's not much. But we go out to them, and their sort of bounce back set of equipment receives sort of a little bit of us that goes to them and answers back to us. We aren't loving them if we don't accept them as being that sort of person and demanding that should be more and more. We will always sort of try to push it a bit more and more and have another go, but we aren't going to come at that with a kind of demand or then feel crushed that we have failed. Affection may be all that we're able, affection may be the good that goes back and forth between us. And what a lot, what an enrichment of our lives that possibility is. We need to be open to the full range of that. Any comment? The sort of people who... There are some people you meet and it just sort of whizzes back and forth. And what enormous fun that is. Then we are getting into the realm of friendship. But for between most of us, it's not a whole lot of things whizzing back and forth. Sometimes we may have to sort of probe a long time before we find anything that sort of whizzes back or even, you know, comes limping back and forth from each other. And the particularity and the uniqueness of love are also a part of the picture. That you try to elicit, to embrace what is the real particular thing about this person. Each person has something in them particularly that's only in them. And it is the way of love to find that and to elicit, to embrace it. We do this at many levels. In conversation, we would... What are the things that a person cares about? And after a conversation, we should ask ourselves, have I gone to live where they're living, or did I insist that they come and live where I am living? And you'll always find something. And even if you are not able to identify any sort of shining particularity, what he talks about rubbing along together is already a whole lot. And so letting each level be the thing it is. For some people, the kind of Holden questions that one asks. And we talk about the weather. Now you can say, well, talking about the weather is a pretty shallow thing. But it's a beginning. It's a shared something or other. And there is, some sort of flow going back and forth. And that may lead on to something more. Or the person may be one who thinks of Holden only in terms of maximum number of trout caught. Well, that would be a kind of identification of a particularity that is then something that you arrive at and can push forward further. The moment one gets under a pressure and you are inhibiting the growth of the more that may happen. This unpretentiousness of affection is a great good to recognize and to be content and happy with. And so one writes affectionately. That's true. Now, there's a potential, of more but one isn't going to be phony about it. And you're not going to work at it under the pressure of a demand. That's the whole business of the law, which is quite other than the way of love, not by coercion. And love is something that happens. The greatest kinds of the loves we come to later on in the book are more and more that you recognize that they're there. They've happened. It's not like building blocks that you do this and do that and do that, then you'll get love. You'll be doing things in affection, and then someday you'll say, well, that person means rather more than affection. The love talk should come as an observation after love has already happened. It is something that happens. Love has that freedom about it, which does not suffer itself to be coerced or to be programmed. And the happening of that love is more likely out of the matrix of rich life of affection. Tomorrow, friendship.